Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a project that uses storytelling and art to rediscover what connects us. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind, and I have the good luck to travel the country and the world photographing people to reveal the beauty and wisdom that's all around us, if we choose to see it. This new season is called Still Here, and for these stories, we traveled to coastal Louisiana. During our 9 days in the state, we heard a lot about disappearance. Not only are marshes and barrier islands vanishing, but so is black-owned farmland. So are the livelihoods of shrimpers and the tradition of eating Gulf seafood. So are local grocery stores, neighborhood music clubs, affordable houses. And yet, we met people who were planting their stakes in this marshy ground saying, "We're still here. We're not going away. This place is too precious to abandon." Their hard work and the work of others like them is key to the survival of the lower 48's most fragile coastline and a model for the rest of the country. Thanks for tuning in to listen to their stories. For this series, we're partnering with longtime friend and journalist Barry Yeoman. Based in North Carolina, Barry has lived and worked in Louisiana and has written extensively about the complexities of culture, environment, and economy along the state's coastline. It's his voice you'll hear leading the interviews.
First, I want to say that I was really excited about being here even before I met you, but standing amidst those giant okra pods makes me even more excited about having this conversation. So thank you for doing this. And maybe we could start by you telling me who you are and where we are.
My name is Christian Bailey. I'm a farmer, grower. I work with natural dyes. I grow some other kind of plants, a little bit of fibers. We are currently located on a farm in Lower Coast Algiers. My farm name is Arais Hand Farm, O-R-A-I-S, Hand Farm. Kind of a weird spelling, but it's kind of got a little bit of ties to kind of like great-great-grandfather and stuff like that. And yeah, this site is right off the Mississippi River. Definitely, you can feel it. Anytime you're here, you're walking around, your boots are squishing in the clay. It feels that way too. Like it's almost like, because I mean, we are underwater right now. You know, and I think it feels that way. And it's like a very strange kind of place to be, both like underwater and on land at the same time.
And we should say that it is the second half of July.
Yeah.
which is
why we look like this.
And it is cover crop season.
Yeah.
And so when we were walking a half hour ago, what were we walking through?
The way that I cover crop is a way I feel like is a little bit unique to how some other people cover crop. My main goal when because I've been on this site for about, in total, 5 years in terms of the whole farm, but like kind of like managing my own space going on 3 years. And through the course of like kind of like experiencing my own personal interaction with farming, I've noticed that like a lot of the plants that are pre-existing can be used as cover crop, you know, in terms of them maybe being like native legumes or cover crops that can fix a lot of things into like being bioavailable to the soil. Some of them are pre-existing here. And I think it's like really interesting to work with the native flora. But we're walking through a little bit of hairy pod, cowpea. I think gave y'all some to taste, the flowers of those. There's a ton of goldenrod out there, and I was talking about the possibility of making some dye out of it in terms of like the flowers and some medicine. But I think it's unique to kind of allow our space to, we like to call it down here, go like feral, where what is now a space that has been cultivated by you is now being essentially cultivated by nature, where you allow it to do what it wants to do. And your goal or your, I feel, responsibility is to monitor and be there and be a part of it, but also be away from it, you know? Because I think human intervention is like a really beautiful thing, but at some point it's also a really beautiful thing to step away.
So hearing you talk now and hearing you talk as we're walking through the field, it's just so evident that the way you think about farming is very different from how a lot of people think about farming. And I'm wondering if we could go back.
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine being the little version of you.
Mm-hmm.
How did you cultivate the love for the land, for the outdoors, for growing things?
Mm-hmm. Growing up where I grew up in Ama, Louisiana. And my little street at some point was like just woods. There were like no houses, you know, and it was a scenario where it was being developed. But at that time when I was growing up, we were surrounded by woods. There's maybe like a couple of houses at the front of the street, but we were pretty much surrounded by woods. And it just felt important for me to be outside as much as I possibly could. I remember being a little bit older and like wanting to like count how many lizards I can, you know, see, or like seeing a bug for the first time that you've never seen before and being like, oh my God, what is this? This is crazy. You know, like these kind of experiences where I'm like, I feel like I was blessed to be able to experience an environment that helped me build an interest. And that interest has pushed me to be in the place that I am now, like where we're having this conversation. And I think that that's one of the most interesting things, where like the little me, like I could have been inside a lot, you know, which I was inside a lot. I was playing with Bionicles, you know, I was doing other things. I was playing with Legos. Had a lot of Dragon Ball Z, like action figures that like I kind of got like beat up to like nothing because they were just getting like hit together. But like that kind of like juxtaposition of like a lot of like alone time inside, using my own like imagination and creativity, and also being outside and being like, dang, there's 15 lizards out here. And my brain being like, whoa, that's a lot of lizards, you know? But that was a blessing. And I feel like, again, it's kind of like that like butterfly effect where it's like all of these little chain like things have linked me to be like sitting here on this little bucket.
On this little bucket.
Yeah.
So maybe you could follow some of those butterflies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's little you that's counting lizards and marveling at a new bug.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere much later, you say, I want to grow things, and I want to grow things in a sustainable way, and I want to grow things that harken back to the heritage of my ancestors. How did you get there?
Mm. I think this is a kind of a connector to a conversation that I had with a friend, like maybe a couple days ago. I think it was Sunday, where she asked me, like, she was essentially asking the same question, like how I got here. And my answer to her and my answer also to you is like through the people that I've met. Like having a particular interest is one thing. And I think that's like one of the most important things to cultivate as like a young person, is like having that like said interest. But the next part of that, which I feel like, again, adds like more of the human element in our own interconnectivity, is that there has to be somebody or something to like spark a thing in you. And I think that as I was like growing up and like not necessarily knowing what I wanted to do, or kind of having like somewhat of an idea, but never being able to like truly like communicate it, I think that the way in which I got to a place to communicate those things were just through like the people I met. Like I had a friend when I was at Xavier. We worked at this community garden, and he's actually the one that introduced me to it. You know, like I had recently like just joined a debate team at Xavier, and that's again where I met some of the most incredible people who I feel like have like put me on this path, where it's like they gave me the confidence, they helped me tackle like my anxieties. It was a space to cultivate friendships and connection. But like that chain, or as you were saying, that butterfly, it kind of flew, landed to this butterfly where it's like now in between classes, me and my friend are like cutting down cover crops, you know, and like I'm going to my microbiology class and I'm like covered in like grass, you know, or something like that, where it's like I was able to be free in that sense and also be blessed to be in relationship with people who also like helped me cultivate my own freedom. I think that my decisions to do these things have a large part been like me, but also I would say even in greater part, having the people around me to inspire the confidence in me to do the thing, you know, because this is not like an easy thing to do. And I think it's also not something that like people want to decide to do, to get into a space to decide to do this work, which again is like really tough, difficult work. You have to be surrounded by people who like make it easier
you know. So that garden at Xavier University, which is in the middle of New Orleans, very, very urban setting.
Yeah.
What was that garden like?
They had raised concrete beds, and some of the alumni or like people that went to Xavier had set it up maybe like a couple years before us. And I think they were maybe inspired a lot by like maybe Cuban agriculture, like post-embargo in terms of like having to like make these permanent raised beds and operate in a way that was a lot more shifting back towards organic functionings of a farm. But they had like pretty long concrete cinder block beds. And at that point, they were all in cowpea cover crop, which I remember like one of us, we were cutting it down and like, we're like, can't we eat these? And like, we're like eating, which they're not good. I'm not gonna lie. Like just fresh. Like, I don't really love the way that they taste, but it is because they are cover crop and they are for the soil. But that little garden was cool because it was the first time that I feel like I had the freedom to interact with a space like at that kind of like level. Like I've been around gardens before, but never where it was like, oh, this is me and my friend right now talking about like what we're gonna like hopefully buy seeds or like dreaming or big picturing this thing. And that was I think one of the sparks that like has initially kind of rolled me down to kind of here.
How long ago was that garden?
That has had to have been maybe about like 7 or 8 years at this point. Yeah.
So there's still some leap from a community garden when you're a college student to farming.
Yeah.
A swath of land across from the levee on the Mississippi River. What happened next?
That garden was a wonderful catalyst, I think. And being at Xavier, being around a lot of folks, I also started working for a nonprofit that was heavily involved in like education around kids between the ages of K through 12th grade. And I feel like that was deeply formative for me as well, because then it created a really strong element of like, wow, like I also want to teach and I want to provide something that is like for other people, you know, outside of just me, like maybe selling vegetables or something else, where it's like, now I feel like I'm instilling something or like being a voice that I needed or wanted to hear when I was younger. So I think that was like the next catalyst of like adding to what I guess I'd call like the gumbo of what this creation is in terms of like how many ingredients are here for me to exist right now talking to you. That instilled a lot in me in terms of what the possibilities could be from just like being a person in the right place at the right time and having conversations with people. Whereas I was trying to like do a lot of things within that program where I wanted kids to also think critically about growing food or to think that it was a possibility to do something along the lines of this, where I feel like a lot of youth, maybe rightfully so, are not interested in farming because of maybe how it's been presented to previous generations or even the inherent trauma that a lot of people who look like me have within the farming space. So I think that was incredibly important in terms of being able to have those conversations and directly hear from these youth that are like, I don't want to do this for XYZ. And then maybe having that be on me to be like, well, what is my way in which I could like inspire you to do these things despite all of these things? I think that job or that time in my life taught me a lot about having those conversations, but also like you can't pigeonhole somebody into doing a thing just because you want them to do a thing. Like I want more youth to be involved in farming, but that doesn't mean or look like every person wanting to be a farmer. It could look like I want to be an accountant for a farmer because you know what farmers need? Accountants, you know, like I want to be like a lawyer and I want to work with people who are dealing with these like mechanisms that take away from people within my community. You don't have to have a rogue tool hoe in your hand and like you're like weeding between basil, you know. You could be the person who's like putting the pen to the paper to make sure that I can keep hoeing the basil, you know what I mean? And like make sure that I stay on land.
And at some point, you decide that you do want to be the guy holding the bow. How'd that happen?
I think it's pretty rad. Wow. 2020 happened. And I think at the beginning of it, I was in New Mexico. And the world was the world at the time. I think it was maybe one of the first times that I felt like a really, really deep chaos. Like I've had moments in my life that I felt like were extremely formative in terms of, like, I don't want to say like my mind breaking, but becoming like fractured to like what the world is, both good and bad, you know? And I think one of the first instances was when Trayvon Martin got murdered, and that being like a fracturing. And then 2020 happened, and that was a fractioning. And I remember like sitting in my house and wanting to be in a space where I was like gardening. And I've had a backyard that had like land since I was like alive. Like we have a really nice sized backyard, thankfully. And I was like, I want to grow food in the backyard. And like my family at the time was like, interesting. Because I guess like, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, that's a cool thing to do. But there's a lot of people who have gardens around me in my part of like town. And they kind of like plant something and forget about it, you know, which I think that they thought that I was going to do that. But at some point, I was like, no, I want to be serious about this. I actually want to, like, do this thing. And I set up my little garden bed, made the garden bed, started gardening and, like, posting on Instagram and being like, yo, isn't this cool? Like, shouldn't more people do this? And, like, having homies be like, oh, this is cool, you know? And that snowballing to, again, like, going back to, like, me being here because of other people, I got a farm apprenticeship at this farm in 2020 purely through like other people. It's completely not within my control in terms of me like knowing about a thing. In my control in terms of the decisions that I made, but like out of my control in terms of like, I didn't see this post. I didn't see this like thing. Like if somebody wouldn't have DM'd me and been like, yo, Christian, you like the garden, there's a farm apprenticeship. And I think I was talking about it a lot. You know, I was like, I really want to farm. I really want to experience these things. And it's like three or four people that I knew who sent me this like this post on Instagram. And I was like, okay. I kind of like scouted the people out. And I was like, oh, these are cool people. Like the folks who like, you know, own the farm or are doing the farming thing. And I was like, okay, this is something that I think that I would want to do based off of like the context of like how we'd be doing this thing. So I applied and got a little interview. I remember it was like raining when I was talking to the ladies, and I was like, this is so interesting. Just like kind of like being in this place and being like, I'm interviewing to be a farm apprentice. This is pretty dope. Especially the context where it's like, I love all kinds of farming. Like I'm super big into like classic tractors. Like that's like when I'm an old man, I want to have a ton of classic tractors. I want to have like a garden tractor collection. And having this context where it was like more human scaled and knowing that this is what this is going to look like, it was like really exciting to see this be like a prospect for my life.
What was that apprenticeship like?
It was really good. We were here before, this sounds crazy, we were here before anything was here. Which in like, what I mean by that is that like everything here was like pasture. You know what I mean? Like there was like some farm infrastructure because of it, you know, inherently being a pasture. You have to have like barbed wire fences and stuff like that. But I remember we were doing split days where we would do like, there's also an urban farm or like an urban garden. So we would do kind of like, it was split weeks actually, where we'd have like a week mainly focusing on like the urban site. And then this site was just starting to be developed. And coming out here and being like, wow, it's just grass. But like, look at it now. It's like not just grass, you know, and it's quite incredible to watch a space become a thing alongside other people, you know, like as I currently am now, I farm on my own. And that's a personal choice in terms of how I want to interact or kind of frame my relationship to the land. But essentially at first it was like a crew of, I think like five of us, and we got a lot done. We got a lot done. And it was like a time of, again, like instilling, I would say like strength in myself. one of the women who owns the farm, her name is Cheryl, and she's a real badass. They're both badasses, but we were weeding spinach in one of the caterpillar tunnels, and it was pouring rain, and we were like like kneeling, essentially like sitting in water in like bibs. And it was like, we just got ourselves through it, you know, collectively with like us being there, like having conversation and being like, we're going to get to the end of this row, you know? And it's like, you do something like that for a couple seasons and you're like, damn, I really can do a lot, you know? Like, for me, at least, it's inspiring to be like, not only am I doing something that I feel like is incredibly important in terms of my own personal work within it, but collectively within the community of all the people who are doing this thing around me, like, they're all badasses. They're all like really dope people. And when you have a lot of people around you who are like that, it continuously inspires you to also be like that.
So you're part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
You're also cultivating this sense of the possible for you, mm-hmm. sense of what you're capable of, sense of your strength.
Mm-hmm.
As you are starting to envision having your own farm, doing this by yourself, what's the vision that's shaping up? How are you imagining your footprint as a farmer will be different from other farms?
Mm. I am often surprised by what a place will look like, what your own input and like relation to it, but also what it could look like without you. You know, we're here right now, like in this moment, but at some point we won't be, and at some point there might not be any people around here, you know, and or maybe at some point the river will reclaim this spot. We have to think about that in the context too of like climate change and what things will look like. But my role right now, currently, I feel like is more so about stewarding things to the best of my ability and learning from the mistakes that I've made in terms of like how to steward a place. In that context, for me, that looks like minimal intervention, deep observation, and time. I think time is like a really important process too. And I think something that like really makes me feel good about the things that I do is that I try to like really limit my inputs in terms of like what I'm using while I'm farming. Like at some point I would like to do no plastic. Like I don't want any landscape fabric. I've never used landscape fabric. I would like to go away from using tarps, which they're an incredible tool for kind of like a no-till operation. They're really, really good. But at the end of the day, I'm like, dang, this plastic has to go somewhere at some point, you know? And, I think, crazy enough, a tool that, like, because I'm really big on tools. We're talking about garden tractors. I like tools, too. I started scything, like, 3 years ago.
Wow.
Which is so, it's like, I say scythe and people are like, my mom calls it a sickle. She's like, where's your sickle? And it started with me being like, dang, this is kind of cool, you know, like, it's a cool tool. There's a cool like history behind it. Like I remember it being like 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm watching like YouTube videos of like people in like Austria or something like that, like scything. And I'm like, damn, this shit is cool as hell. Which again is like maybe not something that like everybody would think, but like if you go watch a scything video at 2 o'clock in the morning with the sound on and like you hear them, you know, that'll put you to sleep. That it put you like straight to sleep. And like it started with that, where it was like, damn, this is cool. How can I relate to it in like my own, you know, context? Where I found a scythe and I was like, dang, where do I get a scythe from? Blah, say, blah. Where can I like kind of like learn how to do this thing? And then I just brought one. And I like started to teach myself the movement, and I started to like teach myself how to kind of like relate to the land in the context of this tool too, because it makes you do things in a different way. Like I mow this site on occasion with like a mower, but mainly it's a scythe, and it's that bush cutter over there, which is like a scythe modernized and also on a lot of steroids, because it's a crazy tool. But that came a little bit later, and the first element of it was me scything all the grass around there and collecting the hay and then using that as a hay mulch for like the field. But like learning this tool and being like, oh, instead of me buying a whole bunch of compost, which compost is great, but sometimes you don't know where your compost is coming from. There's a lot of things that could happen in terms of like persistent herbicides and pesticides and soils and things like that. Where I was like, oh, I can like do a cool thing with a cool tool, learn a skill, and also like make a byproduct from like the same place. Where it's like I'm always like trying my best to like close the loop or like make it tighter in terms of like I want to make compost on site. I want to do these things that are all here right in this place. Cause I think that also think like places like have like this kind of like spirit or like this like ability to relate to your own like work at a space, right? Where it's like, I think nothing is almost in like never in vain, where the hours that I spend out here scything, like it means something, you know, to me, but also like, I know this might sound kind of like heady, but like also I think it means something to the space too. Cause at the end of the day, like we're doing something for like ourselves, but like we're also doing something to reclaim or like interface with a space in a different way. Cause I don't know if I've spoke about it, but this place that we're currently at, this 88 acres, is the largest remaining or was the largest remaining tract of Staten Plantation. Where it's like, again, the things that you do here matter for now, they matter for the past, and also matter for the future. Because me being here is, again, chains of butterflies, but also like deeply tender, I would say, in a way, you know, where like that's another thing that I've learned from like friends is like tenderness or like relating to tenderness, where it's like this place is like really important to me, but it does feel tender. It's a wound. And it is a pre-existing wound that has come before me. And it's up to me to like tend to that wound in a way that I hope will like help it heal, you know, instead of like atrophy.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it, because so much of how we hear about farming is about man's dominion.
It's extractive. It's extremely extractive, you know?
Yeah. So I want to hear more about that.
Mm. There's I'm trying to think of her name, Dr. Marimba Ani. She wrote a book called Yorugu, a African-centered critique on European thought and ideology, I believe. And then one of the things that she defined in the beginning of it was, I think it was desacralization in terms of like our relating to nature in a way that completely separates ourselves from it, right? Where it's like, there is a dominion then where I don't care what's going on here. I care that I have to make X amount of money to do X amount of thing. And that is our own inherent burden, like living within a capitalistic structure, is that people have kids to feed, people have bills to pay, people have these things to do. But I think that like, because we do live in this like really deep, big, booming, like epicenter of like capitalism, is that like people want to go beyond that thing where it's like, not only do I have kids to feed, I just really want to make as much money as I possibly can. I need to like rule over this thing where I would want people to decide to maybe do something a little different, you know, where it's like I have the deepest and utmost respect for conventional farmers. And I think that that's something that like maybe isn't always said by people within this like organic farm space, but like they are the people who feed the people that we love, you know, for the most part. Like I feed people, the folks around me feed people, but overall it is like larger farms who end up feeding the most people. My thing is, how do we relate to these people, or at least like cultivate a generation that's going to come, either is here now or after us, that will, like maybe there's a kid that I'm going to talk to that wants to be a conventional farmer or wants to be a super large scale farmer. How can I have a conversation with that person and be like, you need to do this thing because this is incredibly important, but here's how you can do it and not feel like your main goal is dominion over this land. And then I think that we're seeing that now with a lot of people who are doing regenerative agriculture and how they're deciding to relate to the land, where a lot of these practices, of course, are like age-old practices that are from indigenous folks. But the new invention of them is people being like, oh, yeah, there is another way to do this, which there always was another way to do this, but people starting to, again, like, reframe the fact that we do have options other than I'm going to pass a plow over this and then, like, turn it over every single year, all the time, you know? Where it's like, my main goal is to not do anything to the soil. Once it gets to a certain point, I'm like, you're good. When I move the hay over there and there's like a million roly-polies, I'm happy. And I know that, like, if I do a thing, they're not going to be happy. And I have to think about that, you know? At least for me, that might be more important than how much poundage I can grow. How much can I grow out of this space, but also how much can I respect it too? Where it's like, they have to be here too. This is their home. Like, the things that live here, this is their home. We're here, we're using it for, in a lot of ways, a wonderful thing to feed people. But at the end of the day, you can't negate the fact that there are beings already here that are equally as important.
The tenderness is so evident.
You have to be. Like, that's the, and again, like, in this time that we currently are in, I think that is literally the most important thing that we could focus on, is like, how do we do this thing in a way that is both tender and, like, forward going?
When we start talking about mission, you talked a lot about method.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the mission is also about the choice of crops, right?
Mm-hmm.
Will you talk about how you decided what you would grow? I'm especially interested in your choice of dying crops.
Mm. Part of it came from my own personal research of, like, learning more about this land, learning more about what farming was like in Southern Louisiana, and then being like, how, again, do I interact with this in a way that is both, like, good for me, good for the earth, and also, like, healing for ancestors. I came about indigo through my own research of what was grown here or what was grown around me. Like, I'm from the river parishes. My family has lived in the river parishes for as long as I can, like, think about in terms of, like, you know, great grandma, all this other kind of stuff. And that land, that area is currently heavily populated by petrochemical plants and petrochemical industry, which again is just a next stepping stone within plantation economics, where it's just the same thing, but just, like, in a different way. Whereas, like, a lot of these sites of petrochemical plants were plantations, and they have that same kind of, like, vibe or feel when you're, like, interacting with them. Knowing these things and doing history centered around the river parishes, I learned about, like, Whitney Plantation and the fact that, like, indigo was grown there really early on in terms of, like, settler colonialization of, like, this area, and it being, like, a really important cash crop. And then also just me being like, I really like cool pants. Like, one of the things I like a lot is cool pants. Like, give me some Japanese indigo dyed pants. Like, I need that. Those are nice. I need those, you know? And, like, thinking about that and being like, oh, Japanese indigo. Oh, indigo growing at Whitney Plantation. And, oh, my ancestors have some of the deepest roots and connections to indigo. And, like, learning about folks in West Africa and having these, like, indigo dye pits that are hundreds of years old. And I say this thing, I've, like, taught a couple of indigo dye classes. And one of the things that I do at the beginning is I ask people what they think about indigo in terms of, like, where do they think it came from, or where do they think, what's their most associated thing? And a lot of people do say Japan, because, again, a lot of cool pants come out of Japan or the natural indigo, you know? But then I'm like, there has been such a deep communication and interaction and intimacy of, like, indigo in West Africa, and that being directly tied to America. And then that, like, spiraled me into thinking of so many things of how, like, America is so deeply connected or, like, popularized with, like, jeans, you know, Levi jeans, Lee jeans, Wrangler jeans, all of these, like, blue denim pants. But it's like, a lot of these things are popularized and now a thing because of the work that my ancestors did here in order to build an economy that now is this massive, you know, worldwide economy. And learning all of that and then being like, I want to grow indigo. I want to work with this plant. I want to interface with this plant. I want to see what it's like. And then a local farmer that I know here being like, oh, I have indigo ferrosa fruticosa seeds. Do you want some? And being like, yeah, hell yeah, I do. You know, it's like, again, people outside of me, it's like an idea is sparked in my head or something like that, where it's like, I feel like something comes from outside of me and I'm inspired. And then the pieces fall in place where it's like, oh, I have a homie in the city who grows, who also has the seeds. And it's just like, it's perfect, you know? And then I've been growing indigo for 3 years and processing it, pulling the pigmentation of the plant, turning it into like a dye vat, and just, again, having that be a part of the journey and adding to my own interaction. Because then to me, that becomes deeply more cultural. Because now I'm not only just like a farmer, but like I'm relating to these plants that both have such a storied, wonderful history, but also a storied negative history. And it's about deciding which one that I want to highlight or which one that I want to nurture, I would say.
As you were talking about, I was thinking about, of course, the negative history,
yeah,
the ties to slavery, which are so direct. And I'm curious, you said 3 seasons so far?
3 years.
Three years.
Well, yeah, we can call them seasons too, yeah.
When you've harvested them, what's going on inside you?
Joy, I'm not going to lie. And the reason why I say joy is because at this point, it's almost like, it's weird. I have this like this thought about sometimes that like I'm out here on a farm and I'm working. Like I'll come out here and it'll look like this, you know, where it's like super sunny. It's hot, super hot, oppressive heat. And I'll get out here and then it gets overcast. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And I have this like this thought that I've been like kind of like tossing around in my head. And I'm like, maybe there's people in the ancestral plane that are like, give them a little bit of shade, you know, give them a little bit of reprieve. Where it's like, I hope that has been a constant kind of revolving thing that has happened, where you know the people who are looking out for you within that ancestral plane are always doing something to help you. Where it's like, I'll come out here and I'll harvest indigo. It gets overcast. I'm listening to Dijon. I'm listening to, I don't know, I'm listening to West Saigon. I'm listening to something. I'm always playing music, you know? For me, when I think about it, I'm like, it's so crazy that I could be out here harvesting indigo, about to process the pigment, about to turn this into a vat, and at some point, hopefully make beautiful cloths or things with it. I'm interacting with this ancient plant that has an ancient connection to like my ancestors, my individuality, my anything. And I'm like listening to like Buffalo, New York's greatest rapper, you know, like that's when you ask me, what do I feel? I feel like I feel those things where it's like, I've been out here sad. I've been out here where it's like, dang, I'm sad about something, or like maybe even the work is like saddening, you know, like maybe the crop didn't do what I wanted. But at the end of the day, I think that most of the times that I'm out here, it's either like a deeply healing experience, a joyful experience, or an experience that I needed to have for progression.
It's beautiful. So part of the way that you entered this was working with kids. And it sounds like you're doing more kind of outward looking work as well as the quiet private work of planting and harvesting. It sounds like you're still very much looking out toward the community. Could you talk about that work?
I think to circle back, I do a lot of things out here like alone, where I have so many friends who are like, can I come to the farm to help out? Can I come do this? Can I come do that? And my answer is always yes, but then I also have this like deep hesitation, not just because it is such an intimate space, but it also is the fact that like, because I do the work that I do and I know the physicality of it, I'm always like, dang, I don't want to put my homies through this, you know? Where it's like, there is like this joy of like wanting and needing help. But at least for me and my own personal hiccups, which I feel like is something that I would really want to get over, is that I relate to it in a way where it feels like it is my personal challenge. And part of it came from even things that I read, where it was like, I remember doing the research on indigo and just like learning about like the practices that the planters were doing back then, where there was maybe one enslaved African who was like managing an acre of indigo by him or herself. And I think that sometimes the work that I do is framed within the community work that I do outside of just the farm work, where it's like the dye classes that I do, when people come together and we gather and we learn these things, are some of the most important times that I've like had. But I feel like for me in context, I have to personally do the work to provide the thing like on my own, because it allows me to learn something about myself so that when I'm doing this like dye work, that is the community aspect, the element of it, I can relate to the people in a way that is personally grounded, because I've like, I enter these classes deeply in me, and I'm only deeply in me because I have the time to be alone and to like get into the space that allows me to relate to people in a better way.
I want to sort of open up to the world right now. We're in a weird moment. The work you're doing is so important, and we're surrounded by these forces of non-tenderness, of the opposite of tenderness, of extraction, of not wanting to honor heritages, honor history.
Of violence, I would even say, too.
Absolutely. How much does that enter your headspace?
I think it's constantly there. And I think if it wasn't constantly there, I would have to check in with myself really deeply about like where I was at in terms of my own humanity. I don't know. I learned about this organization in Palestine. I think it's called Tharma, where they're Palestinian farmers who are still growing things in Gaza and trying to grow food for people. Not even trying, succeeding in growing food for people. And I remember like learning about that and coming out here and like sitting right there in my truck and crying and being like, damn, the work that I'm doing is so incredible. But like, look around the world and look around at the fact that like, I come out here and I do the things that I do. I plant, I weed, I hoe, I seed, I do all of this work. And again, like I'm a lot of times joyous, but then I reframe it in a context of, what if I was doing this and every single plane that flew past my head, I was deeply worried about that being my last moment on Earth. And we live in the center of empire, and here there are bases, planes fly past all the time, but I don't have that inherent fear because of where I am in context of the world. And I think that if we can all have that in our brains, I think it would push us to think about the work that we're doing in a way that is more tender, where it's like, we are so privileged in a way that I feel like is a responsibility. It is my responsibility to have these conversations and to include these things in these conversations because of my privilege of this existence. And I think that for us to do better and to combat the things that we're currently faced with in this world is to know that and to try our best to move every single day within that. And I've had a conversation before where I talked about it being like a fear, where it's like, you have to move within the fear in order for you to combat the fear. And again, to circle back, the only reason why I'm able to say these things, to do these things, is because of the influence of other human beings around me who have done the thing already and who are doing the thing now and have that that juxtaposed context of relating to things in a way that makes me think, wow, I don't have to worry about that in this context. They do. They're doing the work. I should be inspired to continue to work too. And that's, to me, one of the most important things.
One thing that strikes me as you're talking is that there's, of course, the violence of the moment, but also you are at the epicenter of one of the most extractive places mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean,
even currently at this exact moment.
At this exact moment and in this exact place, you mm-hmm. just have to walk across the levee. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that industrial operation is, but it's...
That's either Domino or that might be a refinery. It's yeah. one or two.
So as you are surrounded by corporations sucking the oil and the gas out of the earth, you are cultivating both the natural and the tender. Mm-hmm. You must be aware of that complication all the time.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a friction. Because again, like you were saying, you go up on a levee and you see these things and you're like, damn. And for me, in the context of still living in River Parishes, like I live in Cancer Alley. I deal with this on a daily. I pass by a plant to get to my house, you know. And again, I'm aware of the fact that this is an extension of plantation economics. I'm aware of the fact that I live in a community where this might be the best option for a lot of people because this is the way in which you, again, feed, provide, grow your family. And I think that, like, in the context of... it's like this, like, mega infrastructure, like, every time that I pass it, you know. Where I think about what existed before it, I think about what is happening now, and I think that, like, one of my main challenges to deal with this inherent fear that I was talking about that I feel like everybody feels but maybe kind of goes against in my personal battle is I can't conceptualize what this giant infrastructure would look like if it wasn't there. And I think that that's where my own kind of creativity needs to be stretched, where it's like, I pass these chemical plants every single day. I should be able to think about what this land could or should look like if it wasn't here, but I can't. And that's my sticking point. And I hope that maybe I continue to have conversations where people help me reinvent a world that is not this current one, or a better world. But I think it is, I'm really happy you brought that up, because I think that that is one of the most important things to highlight about this region, which in my mind, I've lived here my whole life. I've lived in Louisiana my whole life. Louisiana is one of the most beautiful places, in my opinion, in the world. People are like, damn, it's hot out here. It is. Super hot out here. Damn, it's humid out here. It is. Super humid out here. But this place, in my opinion, is absolutely magical. And I should be able to conceptualize what it would look like outside of this mega infrastructure. And my goal is to have those conversations that extend my own imagination to being able to see what that is. Because it's daunting. It's, again, super scary to interact with and to know. But the goal is to, again, cultivate more conversations like this where people can think about what our future would look like, walking in that fear, but also walking in the possibility of, like, a future that, like, kind of, like, numbs that fear, makes that fear possible for us to work within.
Christian, this feels like a beautiful stopping point. But before we stop, I want to ask if there's anything that I haven't asked you about that you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think it's really wonderful how deeply connected people are by accident. And I think that, like, this initiative or this thing that we're all doing here is so crazy to me because, like watching y'all set up and watching y'all, like, do y'all's thing, I don't know how to do none of this. You know what I mean? Like, this is, like, crazy. Like, there's a mic in my face. I've never had a mic in my face. This is nuts. But y'all are the people who, like, make this a thing, and we all, like, kind of create a thing together. And I think it's so crazy that, like, people can be strangers, but then have a connecting point that makes us feel like less strangers. Like, I recently went to this really incredible restaurant called Dakar. It's a Senegalese tasting menu, and I was sat at a table with, like, 5 or 6 strangers. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I've never been in this scenario like that. But, like, being placed in a scenario like that around strangers, you start to learn that, like, there's a lot more within us that is deeply more relatable and connected than there is, like, separating. And I think it does start with, like, conversations, and maybe those conversations being ones that are, like, planned like this one or unplanned, It's like you just need to have a willingness to talk. Yeah, you need to have a willingness to hear, and you need to have a willingness to stew on things, stew on conversations, sit with them, and like hold them in tenderness.
My heart is full. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Still Here, a series produced by A Piece of My Mind. I'm John Noldner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind. Be sure to visit our website, listed in the episode notes, to see photos and video from this story. This series is produced with interview help from journalist Barry Yeoman, editing help from summer interns Kate West, Sawyer Garrison, and Caitlin Emai, and audio production by Rosic Saifullah.